the way we go about our day, which obviously involves our self-care, all of that is very habitual. Our mental worlds are so habitual. We tend to tell ourselves the same narration, the same stories.
Welcome to the Drew Perrault Podcast. Each week, we explore the inner workings of the brain and the body with one of the brightest minds in wellness, medicine, and mindset. This week's guest is Dr. Nicole LaPera, and we're talking all about breaking old patterns, letting go of the past, and most importantly, stepping into the true, more real version of who you are. Nicole is a trained clinical psychologist who was trained at Cornell University and the New School for Social Research. She's the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, How to Do the Work, and the podcast host of the Self Healer Soundboard. As a clinical psychologist, Nicole often found herself totally frustrated by the limitations of traditional psychotherapy. Wanting more for her patients and for herself, she began a journey to develop a united philosophy of mental, physical, and spiritual health that equips people with all the tools necessary to truly heal themselves. Dr. LaPera's latest book is called How to Meet Yourself, and it's a workbook for anyone who's interested on a practical step-by-step approach to truly meeting their authentic self. On today's podcast with Dr. Nicole LaPera, we cover a whole host of topics, including how to access the mind through the body and the techniques that Nicole uses to do exactly that. Stay tuned for a fantastic podcast with Dr. Nicole LaPera. Dr. Nicole LaPera, welcome back to the podcast. I'd love to jump right in by asking like a really big picture question. What do you think are some of the top things, just anything that comes to your mind, and obviously in the spirit of the new book, what are some of the top things that get in the way from people actually connecting with what they really want in life?
That's a really great place to start. First, thank you, Drew, for having me back on the podcast. If I can throw out, I'll throw out a big global one word, our childhood. I believe our conditioning, all of these thoughts about who we should be, who we need to be maybe at one point to keep ourselves safe, oftentimes becoming an habitual adaptation gets in the way of what we want. When we feel like we need to be some particular way to survive, it's really, really difficult to really tune into things like wants, desires, and things like that.
So in a way, to extrapolate on that, is that it's the adherence to the way that we think we should be that gets in the way of what we actually really want in life.
Yes, absolutely. And all of the then habits that come along with those should type thinkings, from habits that govern the way we treat our body, oftentimes based in beliefs, again, that were instilled in us in childhood, to habits around our emotion, our emotional world, how we should be, what we should show emotionally, what we shouldn't show emotionally. And then that, of course, that disconnection between what is actually happening inside of us and what we're then expressing to the world around us.
I'd love to pull on that thread of habits a little bit, because that's an early part of the book that's there. And what are some examples? Like, can you give us some examples of habits that some of us may be engaging on a regular basis without even necessarily knowing it? We may not be aware that are things that we're sort of unconsciously committed to that get in the way. Like, what are practical examples, do you think?
Yeah, I think habits govern our life outside of just, I think traditionally when we think of habits, we think of, okay, what are the lifestyle choices, new habits that we want to create for ourselves? But in reality, humans are habitual creatures from, again, the way first thing we do when we open our eyes, if you were to observe yourself, or if most of us were to observe ourselves, even for the many of us that are like, oh, I don't have habits, I don't have morning routines or any routines in general. The way we go about our day, which obviously involves our self-care, how are we sleeping? How are we eating? How are we moving our body or resting our body? All of that is very habitual. Peeling back a layer of the onion, a little less objective, our mental worlds are so habitual. We are constantly narrating life. Our mind is seeking to make meaning of our experiences, and we tend to tell ourselves the same narration, the same stories. So in emotional ways, in mental ways, we are recycling patterns, again, from early childhood, whether it's how we're caring for our body, to how we're narrating our life, to how we're dealing with our emotions, to how we're relating in our relationships, and so on.
You know, this quote in the early part of the book, it says, I've yet to meet a human who is fully aware of all the patterns that hold them back. Can you expand on that a little bit? Like, What do you see when you look out in the world, the conversations that you have with people? You were just talking about having a conversation with your Uber driver on the way over here. Mm-hmm. What do you see in the world when it comes to these patterns and the awareness that people have around them?
I think we lack awareness quite largely. I think so many of us are governed from that autopilot, which just can be really emotionally driven, that things happening to us, we don't even realize that we're factoring in. Even the description I just gave, our mental world is narrating or coloring our experiences. So many of us don't even tune into that. Stimulus happens, event happens, and we catch ourselves mid-reaction out or on the other side of the reaction, not understanding that a very big bridge happened in terms of how our mind made sense of that. And I think that so many of us live unconsciously. We're not even aware that we are participating in the experiences around us. So becoming conscious, seeing ourselves, seeing the mental world that's narrating our events, seeing the emotional world, seeing how we cope or tend with our emotions can be that factor or sense, that point of participation that we're playing.
Let's talk about your story. We talked a little bit about it before, but just in the context of this, patterns getting in the way, unconscious patterns getting in the way, and sometimes even causing disease in the body or suffering in the body, which is many people that maybe that their first indication that something is off, just a general sense of feeling not great. So would you mind just talking big picture about your story? You were in clinical practice, right, with patients, working as a psychologist, and something started to happen. What started to happen?
This episode is brought to you by Inside Tracker. So I've experimented with every eating approach in the book. I'm talking about raw foodist, vegan, vegetarian, meat eater, you name it, I've tried it. And the truth is, at first, I felt pretty darn good on all of them until I didn't. Now, through a bunch of trial and error, I found that following one specific eating style wasn't the answer for me. And maybe it hasn't been the answer for you either. That's why I'm super excited about the company Inside Tracker. Inside Tracker helps take the guesswork out of living optimally. By looking at your blood work, DNA, and personal preferences, they create a nutrition, exercise, and lifestyle plan that's specifically designed for you. And now you can connect Inside Tracker to your Apple Watch to unlock deeper, more precise insights into your health. With real-time exercises, resting heart rate, and even sleep data synced with your Inside Tracker plan, you can truly wear your health on your sleeve. Right now, Inside Tracker is offering my podcast community a very special offer of 34% off your order. Just go to insidetracker.com/Drew, that's D-H-R-U, to get your discount code and try it for yourself. That's inside, I-N-S-I-D-E, tracker, T-R-A-C-K-E-R.com/D-H-R-U for 34% off until the end of November.
You know what's been a game changer for me as far as my fitness goes, my daily performance, and my overall health? Sleep. But you know, sleep is not as simple as just closing your eyes and hoping for the best. The quality of your sleep is ultimately what matters the most, which is why I love wearing my Whoop device. Whoop is a personalized digital fitness tracker and health coach platform that monitors your physiology 24/7. Whoop helps me figure out my ideal sleeping schedule and gives me a sleep score every morning that's based on how the sleep I get compares with the sleep my body actually needs based on my activity from that day. Whoop also monitors my heart rate variability, resting heart rate, and respiratory rate, and uses these numbers to give me a recovery score. This recovery score number lets me know how hard I can push my body the next day, which is very important for me to manage my expectations and feel my best. And it calculates my physical stressors and gives me a strain score, which is super helpful for giving me the nudge I need on busy weeks to make fitness a priority. Right now, Whoop is offering my community 15% off their Whoop membership. Just go to join.whoop.com and use the code DREW15 at checkout. That's join.whoop.com and enter the code DHRU15 at checkout for 15% off any Whoop membership. Now let's get back to today's episode.
So at that time in my life, I mean, I would have located myself at the end of having checked a lot of boxes that I thought, you know, were important to me. I had a successful private practice. I was living in the city very close to my hometown. I had, you know, a social life. I was in a committed relationship. Yet I would find myself day after day not only feeling disconnected and unfulfilled, but really unwell, exhausted, depleted on a deep level. And it took me exploring the role that I was playing and seeing how little I factored myself into my choices. I mean, even being so performance driven for so long, so looking outside of myself for feedback, for validation, even becoming the clinical psychologist that had that private practice, for me, served me at one time in one place, but wasn't necessarily connect it to myself. And when I began to explore the habits that I was carrying from childhood, I saw a lack of self-care in general. And not only did I overstep my emotions, my limits, I never made space for me to share what I thought or felt with, you know, my friends, my loved ones. In terms of my body, I had a lot of habits in terms of how I was caring or not caring for my body that were causing, to speak to your point, physical, probably on the brink of disease. I was feeling depleted energetically. I started to faint, lose consciousness, and many other things.
To connect the dots, because I was asking you what gets in the way of us knowing what we want, you know? I mean, it's kind of like a joke. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about it when it comes to, you know, basic things in life, like, what do you want to eat? Well, I don't really know. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do here? Well, I'm not sure. But really, it's this larger element of like knowing what we want and actually being able to tap into it. Like, what do you want in life? And a lot of people actually feel, I don't know what I want in life. And it's tough for them because they can't connect to that inner sensation. So if our childhood is a thing that gets in the way of us connecting with that inner voice inside of knowing what we want, what would be an example of something that you went through in your childhood? Either something that was there that got in the way or something that was not there that didn't support the connection that later expressed itself as a pattern in adulthood.
Yeah, I really appreciate you even acknowledging the lack of, because I think a lot of times when we think of childhood trauma, you know, suffering, we think of instances of abuse, you know, active things that happened to us, boundaries that were violated that of course shouldn't have happened. Though me looking back on my childhood, not seeing those moments for a really long time, I wondered why I was struggling in the same ways, having the same patterns that I saw in humans that had those moments of abuse. So what I began to understand is it is a conversation sometimes on what is not present. And what was not present for me was having an emotionally attuned caregiver. In absence of having a human who was able to help me navigate, explore my emotions, emotions make us largely who we are. They're a point of self-expression, and not feeling safe enough and not having a curious caregiver, because my caregiver herself was locked in her own survival mode from her own past experience, tending to consistent stressors in my daily life, which included my older sister who had her own chronic illness, there was a lack of emotional connection and support. So when we don't have support to navigate the daily life ups and downs, emotions that happen, we can quite easily feel overwhelmed. And then we shift into that compensation mode. And what that looked like for me, seeing and experiencing a whole lot of stress in the family that was already overwhelming the system's ability to cope, I did two things. I learned to show nothing that could stress the system. I wouldn't bring my problems to my mom. I wouldn't express when I had a difficult day at school, because what I'd seen time after time of doing that, it would destabilize my mom. She would become so upset over how I was feeling that I would end up feeling worse. So I began to limit what I showed my family, and I learned very quickly that the way to get attention, love, connection from my mom in particular was not only by limiting issues, but by performing. And for me, that was really quickly became evident that I was talented in softball. I was talented at school. So I shifted into a doing mode of squashing down my true feelings, my authentic self, and shifting into this performance-driven mode that brought me up through that private practice, hanging my shingle, though ultimately because I wasn't being true to who I was. I had a lifetime now of not expressing myself, of continuing to overstep my limits in favor of performing for someone else. I was left with a whole lot of unmet needs and a whole big disconnection from my authentic self.
Can you expand on that a little bit more on the topic of you weren't being true to yourself? What does it actually mean to look at that statement and for us to really feel it? What does it mean to be true to ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, that's everything from objectively, you know, not censoring when you have an instinct to share a thought, to share a feeling, to just express yourself or to be whatever it is that you're, you know, wanting to be in that moment. All of those inner critics, all of the desires to self-censor, Not doing that would be, you know, living in that full self-expression. That means being connected to what we think, what we feel about any given experience, and then obviously having the courage and the confidence to share that with the world. What most of us do, if we're even connected to what we think, what we feel, what we want, we might not feel brave enough, or we might not feel comfortable enough, or we might not feel safe enough to say it, because maybe in times past when we've said it, it wasn't received, it wasn't open, it wasn't welcome. So then we enter self-censoring. So I think we fall in one of two camps. We either know or have an idea of those deeper instincts, inclinations, desires, and then we self-censor, or some of us are so disconnected that I remember a very pivotal time when I was talking to a friend about some stress I was feeling about an obligation. What should I do about a given circumstance or event that was coming up? And my friend very calmly looked at me and said, after I'd went down a litany of what everyone else wanted of me for that event, she looked at me and she just said, well, what do you want? And I couldn't even answer what I wanted, how I wanted to spend that particular Saturday, let alone these deeper questions. So I share that again as an example of that complete disconnect where I had stopped making a habit of even checking in with myself, that I was so far away that I didn't even yet know.
And do you think it's this idea that through the performative, which everybody has their own version of that, right? Yours is coming through high achievement, right? Is one of them, is I'm hearing. Sort of to counterbalance that component of what you felt like either you weren't getting, or this is how I get love from other people. Was it as simple as that? Like your body's internally feeling, whether you realize it or not, like if I do this enough, then everybody will like me. Is it that simple?
In terms of keeping the pattern going?
In terms of like keeping the pattern going and it running inside, like what's the hope for the body's end goal by keeping this pattern alive when you were in it? Is it that finally I'll be loved?
Safety. I believe our body becomes so patterned around the way that once kept us safe. So if showing this self-expression in childhood was minimized, or maybe we were outright shamed for it, then I have a message that I'm not safe to show that. So then I continue the pattern of repressing or suppressing that in the belief that showing it would lead to that same reaction, that same lack of safety. And then our body literally becomes wired in terms of having this idea around that which is safe, usually based around solely that which is familiar to us. So most things, and this is why I've evolved the clinical practice that I began working much more from the mind only to incorporating the body into the conversation.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things in here about the body, which we'll get to in a second. And you have this quote inside the book that I pulled out, and you said on the topic of body, you said, many of us have left our bodies because we're overwhelmed, stressed, or have unresolved trauma, making our physical self feel unsafe. When did that aha moment occur for you? Like where you actually felt it for yourself? Like not you just understood intellectually, that the idea that we can't solve all these challenges that we're going through just through the mind. We actually have to involve the body. When did that like actually for real click for you that you're like, whoa, I'm experiencing this as a healing, as part of my healing journey?
For me, it conceptually clicked, you know, when I read about it, when I learned about it, because it really was the missing piece of explanation with why so many of us, myself included, had so much insight when I would work with clients. We would have plans of action to break those old habits, yet time and time again, we wouldn't be able to actualize on those plans. So conceptually, it was like the missing piece immediately. But to speak to your point, it wasn't until I got really consistent myself on my body self-care, until I made myself a bedtime and made sure I stuck to that bedtime and got the amount of rest that I needed to make sure I fed myself nutrient-dense foods. For me, breath work and integrating, you know, active tools to regulate my nervous system into my daily practice was transformational. And of course, it wasn't immediate. Building in those lifestyle habits, you know, small promise at a time until they were consistent somewhere down the line. Then I gifted myself the experience of, oh my gosh, not only do I feel connected in my body, I'd spent so much time feeling so disconnected, but that I actually can, it doesn't feel so bad. It's not so overwhelming. I can begin to tune into the sensations, the shifts, other changes that naturally happen as I'm going about my day without feeling so overwhelmed by them. So essentially, I think simply when I came into my own body, which to me indicated that it was safe enough in there because I had practiced meeting the needs of my body for consistent enough time before then.
It sounds like a really basic question, but I often find that in the process of people gathering awareness and starting to step into this work, one thing that helps them realize is the cost of not having it. And many people are not at rock bottom. They're not at a place where it's bad enough that they've gotten that eviction notice from their body, which often sometimes leads to transformation, sometimes it doesn't. They're sort of in that in-between spot where they don't feel good. Things don't feel the best. They don't have the energy they want. They feel like something's off. And it's a little bit of like that background noise. What is the cost of living your entire life without meeting your true self?
Yeah. I think when our body, you know, our body is such a wealth of wisdom. And when our body isn't, you know, feeling well in those areas, or when we're not simply consistently meeting our body's needs, we shift into a survival mode. So to answer the question, then we are disconnected inherently from our authentic self. When we have to survive, or when our body believes it has to survive, it will prioritize the immediate moment and what I need to do to continue on to that next moment. And when we talk about, I mean, even in the book, I offer an adapted version of an authentic needs pyramid, with the basic needs being the physical needs, followed by the emotional needs. And then the authentic needs are at the tip of the pyramid. That includes reconnecting with my passion, my imagination, and my creativity. When our body thinks it's in survival mode, that's absolutely the farthest thing from a priority. So consistently, if our body isn't feeling well, and if we aren't well, the risk or the byproduct will be we won't be able to actually truly meet who we are, because our body will be so consumed calorically even with prioritizing its survival into the next moment. Creation, imagination, all of those things that truly are part of who we are take the back burner. And for some of us, if we live in that survival mode for the entirety of our life, we will never then have the opportunity to meet ourselves.
I think that's such an important point. And I saw the pyramid inside of the book. It's a reminder that we can't just jump to this idea that we're going to find our true self. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, I know you kind of just did, but it warrants a doubling down on that.
Yes, I appreciate you pausing here for that doubling down, Drew. And I very intentionally imagining people are going to pick up this book, Workbook for Self-Discovery, right? Self, my authentic self. Oh, great. Let me skip to section 3, I very intentionally broke the book up into reflect that pyramid, where the first section is all about the body and reintegrating the body and rebalancing the nervous system in the body. And then we progress into the mind and all that lives in our emotional worlds, our inner child, our ego, our shadow, and everything that's coloring our body's experience. And then again, ultimately, strategically, it comes in chapter 3 or in section 3, authentic self. Because until we peel back all of the layers of the onion, until I feel safe enough in my body to explore my mental world and all this reactivity from wounds that I've been carrying from my childhood, and then I can get grounded in even what's really happening and allow my full self-expression, then I can finally meet what that full self-expression is. So I always go back to the onion analogy, and again, even strategically place the section that I imagine will be the reason people pick up the book at the end, because I understand that we want to dive, we want to meet who we are, know what, you know, our essence is. But if our body's not safe, if we're being colored by filters from our past experience, or if we're allowing our subconscious mind, I should say, and our ego to color our experiences, then we're not going to be safe enough to essentially be who we are.
A few years ago, I came up with this goal setting practice, and people would always say, like, do you have a methodology for goal setting? And I said, you know, sometimes I'll do goals, sometimes I won't. I kind of like try it on. I do it for a little bit, then I don't do it. Like, I'm not married to any specific thing. But one thing that I've found from teaching a lot of people sort of this way that I go about stuff, including, you know, walking my wife through it as well, is that when most people enter into the space of wanting to, let's say, have a goal around something, and that could even just be an intention around getting better or slowing down, whatever it be. Often, when we do it at the end of the year or the beginning of the year, we're entering into it from a place of lack. Here's all the stuff that I didn't get done, and now here's all the stuff that I want to do. It's kind of like the subtext. So I got people in this habit of, we are going to go through the entire year, and we're going to ask 3 questions. We're going to ask, for every month, we'll ask these 3 questions and pull out some highlights from the month. It's best to do with the calendar. The first one is, what's something tough or challenging that I did this month that even if it didn't work out the way that I wanted to, I attempted it, right? Just like I even jumped into the ring, right? So I want to write that down, acknowledge that. The next one is, who is someone out there, no matter how big or small, that did something for me? And the last one is, no matter how big or small, who's someone that I did something for? And when we take the moment to sort of recognize how far we've come and recognize like just how much we've come to the table, we enter into the place of setting intentions, goals, whatever it is that people want to do, with a whole different mindset. It's like now there's a recognition of who I truly am. In a way, I see like this first section here of entering back into the body. It's this reminder that you call it being safe. Another word, because I find that that word doesn't always resonate with people. Like I have a men's group and like some for some, well, it could be strong. That's another version of it. Mm-hmm. You're strong. Like, fine. You don't want to use the word safe. Like you are strong. You recognize your body. You're in your body. You're here. And like you're 100% complete in this moment. And so I feel like the dots that I wanted to connect, because I've talked about a little bit of the goal setting practice on the podcast before, is that you have to go through the body to enter into the next spaces that you want to get into. So if that's the case, and I know it's kind of like you can choose from a lot of different options that are there, what do you think is step one for most people if they're going to access through the body that sense of safety or being strong?
Having a conscious relationship with our body, actually tuning into what's happening in our body, turning that attentional focus to the breath that's going, you know, through our lungs, to the sensations, how even physically right now it feels to be sitting in this chair with these lights on me. That's such a simple, I think, a lot of the work really is in these simple practices, though embodying the simplicity actually shows how complex it is, because so many of us, again, shift our focus for many different reasons. So really learning how to attune our attention and presence in our physical body, which seems like such a minute, easy thing to do, though in action, it rekindles, I think, and reconnects us to the physical presence below. And then I think a lot of us hear practices like this, maybe toss it in our back pocket for, you know, the time when I need to be in my body to regulate my emotions, and we don't practice it consistently enough. So I think it's learning to reconnect consistently with our body, to build in many moments where we just teach ourselves how to consciously, and how it feels to be consciously in the different unique bodies that each of us are living in.
One of the first sections that's inside of the book, and by the way, link in the show notes, How to Meet Yourself, the workbook for self-discovery. You can pick it up. It's available now. One of the first sections is breath work. And just even breathing, I would say. Like sometimes we call it breath work because maybe we're not paying attention to it, but it's even just being aware of your breath. And there's a bunch of different tools that are there. What has been one of your top tools in that category of being aware of your breath that was helpful for you when you were starting your journey? Anything stand out?
Yeah, in the beginning of my journey, discovering how, you know, disconnected I was, and understanding that for me that was coming from a shutdown state of my nervous system, I really relied very heavily on Wim Hof's method of more vigorous stimulating breathing to help activate, which for so long, so much consistent overwhelming stress, my nervous system, my body was actually, which made sense why I was losing consciousness, was beginning to shut down. All of my energy was immobilized as opposed to mobilized. So for me, it was actually the opposite, I think, that some of us hear of the calming, the deep belly breathing, which definitely has had a role in my journey. But for me, it was actually waking and stimulating my body with that more vigorous Wim Hof. And I got very committed. I made a daily practice during my morning routine where I would actually pop in one of his YouTube videos and allow him to take me through his guided practice, help stimulating, you know, the energy, mobilizing my body's resources, and then over time learning how to calm myself by doing that deep belly breathing. So it became a little bit of both, but I really hung my hat on the beginning on that more vigorous, stimulating movement practice to help me activate what for so long was shut down.
Are there any patterns that you can describe out, like how people handle themselves in conflict, or how, like, are there any other examples that you have that if somebody's like, maybe that's me, maybe I'm somebody who's like a shutdown personality. I don't know if there's like a word to be used towards that. Are there any other things that people who are typically in that situation and had an upbringing that led to that? Yeah, like how would you be in conflict? How would you be in other situations when you were running that pattern? I'm trying to just give examples because maybe somebody in our audience is like, maybe that's me.
Yeah. So shut down, you know, we can feel very flat emotionally, very numb. And we might have a I'm just describing that kind of first pattern of myself. We might have a trouble not feel very motivated, not feel very energetic, very lethargic all of the time, might have blank mind, unable to even like stimulate thought a lot of the time. Other end of the spectrum, we can become very emotionally reactive, unable to be responsive. We have a feeling and we're shouting, we're yelling, it's coming outward. And then there's, of course, every iteration in between. Our goal, of course, is to deal with stress, to notice when I'm feeling stressed and notice when I'm feeling upsetting emotions, to take the information that that provides us, but to remain responsive, not to kind of hit either end of that spectrum where we're exploding outward, we feel so out of control, we're so overwhelmed by our emotions, or we almost feel like we don't have emotions and we're completely shut down. I think those are the kind of two really common examples that also indicate that nervous system state. Of course, I was in the final stage, my nervous system had shut down, that explosive situation that I'm describing is usually, again, when we're in that fight or flight mode and everything feels like a threat and we literally spring to a defense by screaming, by yelling, again, in an attempt to keep ourselves safe.
So would that be under the subtext of a dysregulated nervous system, right?
Yes.
So somebody who has, again, I don't know if I'm using the right word, but like a shutdown, you know, primary mm-hmm. response. And then within that, do you... Is it primarily so in the book you have the section where you talk about fight or flight, then you go into freeze, you talk about these response systems that people have, and they're not necessarily bad on their own. Another one is fawning. They're not bad on their own, but it's when we get stuck in these as the primary pattern and we can't actually pull ourselves out of it, or we don't know why we get triggered into them. So do some personalities or some childhood experiences have people go towards one of those more than the other?
Yeah, so they're very universal and common in terms of the sequence. When we feel stressed, the first thing we'll do is we'll attempt to fight or flee the stressor at hand. Our energy will mobilize, we'll outwardly attack, or we'll escape, we'll distract ourselves, we'll leave the room. Again, if the stressor is too big, too overwhelming, then we'll go into that shutdown. So the sequence of the stages are really universal. But then, of course, depending on the relationships around us, the environment around us, the needs that were consistently met or unmet in childhood might determine what response we're likely to cycle in.
So going back to accessing through the body, so breath work is one of those components. What is another component, another tool in the workbox that people can be using to step back into their body? And of course, you mentioned even before breath work, we talked about just general body consciousness.
Yeah.
Right? Is there anything else that's in that toolbox related to the body and accessing the body?
Mm-hmm. When we're talking about, you know, general body consciousness, I think another great foundational tool is grounding type practices, learning how it feels not only to be present in my body, but a great place that we can utilize grounding type techniques are out in nature. If we have a patch of grass or a park that we like to go to, actually feeling our body in connection with the earth, which is a very naturally calming energy for most of us. I think those are really helpful times because safety is important. My body has to feel safe for me to enter it. So for me, I remember, as long as I can remember, nature was always one of those places where I felt a little more grounded, just a little more present, a little more at peace in my body. So for the many of us whose body feels overwhelming and unsafe, I think when we couple that body awareness or the practice of just tuning the attention, like I said, sitting in this chair, my heels on the earth, if I'm actually on the physical earth, sitting, laying, whatever it might be, then I think that can help be a safer space or help rebuild a safe connection in our body. So nature, I think, becomes another helpful tool for body type work.
All simple tools, but it really just brings up, is it just a matter of like the frequency that we're bringing them into our life with and sort of the intention? Is that really just the difference? Like, because a lot of people are like, I do make time a little bit. It's kind of like you go to Times Square, you ask people like, hey, do you eat healthy? And everybody's like, yeah, of course I eat healthy. I have like 5 Coca-Colas a week, you know, or somebody's like, I have 5 Coca-Colas a day, but my brother has 10. So of course I eat a little bit healthy. So even though some people are doing some of this stuff a little bit here and there, and there's plenty of people that are not, right? There's plenty of people that are not doing any kind of breath consciousness or anything like that. Is it simply a matter of the frequency that we're intentionally bringing them in our life with to get the benefits?
It's the consistency, the frequency, and it's also in the moments of activation, because I think a lot of times we can get really committed to routines, to habits that serve us. And then in those moments where we feel activated or triggered by our partners, by our family or whomever it is, we revert. Those are the moments that we're most likely to revert to the oldest ways that we've learned to cope with our emotions in particular. So it's the consistent foundation of many of these practices and then applying those same tools, because usually in those heated moments are where all of that work, all of those habits go out the window. So I think it becomes a coupled approach where we want to be consistently conscious to ourselves in the wholeness and all of the ways, our emotions, and in particular, because we're all interpersonal beings, our relationships is where a lot of our patterns live that are the hardest to change.
And I think universally a lot of people can feel that they relate to this, but why do we get thrown off and go back to those old things, right? Those old habits and things, even though we know that sleeping on time, doing our practices, being intentional. So if it's conflict or if it's a stressful situation, but usually that situation is then it's done. But what keeps us sometimes from not going back to the practices that we know work for us? What are your thoughts on that?
We're driven to that, to the familiar in so many ways. So before long, you know, we will revert back to that which we know, especially in those moments where if our safety, if our emotions are feeling challenged, if we're feeling dysregulated, like those heated moments I was just talking about, those are the ones that we become most likely to rely on the habitual ways that we've known to cope. Because even if it's not a great byproduct, if I know that screaming and yelling, right, kind of logically or not illogically keeps me safe in this moment, it doesn't seem like it's the choice that I want to make next time. However, screaming and yelling for however long I've repeated that pattern has created some semblance of at least believed safety for me.
Familiar. It's just familiar. So even that can feel like safety.
Even that. The familiar will always feel like safety to our mind and to our body, just seamlessly because it becomes predictable. We know our subconscious mind fills in what happens next. Now I can divert calories away from even paying attention to it and put those somewhere else. So our body will always gravitate toward the familiar, especially, like I said, when we feel unsafe and when we're having an emotional reaction that's based on that lack of safety, that explosion, that's when we become even more gripped into that old way of navigating that. Even if we have a million new tools at our disposal, we'll revert back because we can be assured we know what happens next.
I think actually this is a good opportunity to talk about, just in the description and unpacking it a little bit, the word safety and our expectation around ourselves making ourselves safe versus other people making us safe. There's a lot there and people have a lot of different feelings about it. And it's natural that people kind of run with their feelings when they hear a word like, whoa, safety, like, whoa, everybody's supposed to make you safe in this situation. So can you talk about the combination of both working with the people in our life and personal responsibility about leading the efforts around the growth around this area?
Yeah, I think one of the most difficult things to tolerate as a human is that we can't control really anything outside of ourselves. We can't control our loved one. We can't necessarily control the environment around us. We can only control how we respond or what we do with what is happening. And even emotions in general, I mean, the way I'm even describing them, they live in our body, their sensations, they really are in ownership hours. Yes, they become activated when things happen around us, when we run them through a filter, we make a meaning out of them, then we have an emotional reaction, but ultimately they're ours. And for a very long time, I pointed to the outside world in hopes of, oh, if you just stop doing this thing, I won't feel this way. If you become a different partner in some way, I'll feel more fulfilled in my relationship again, not understanding that the role I was playing. So whether we're talking about dealing with our emotions or creating safety, yes, our environment is playing a role, though we can really empower ourselves if we look at how are we interacting with our environment. Do I need to take space? Do I need to set a limit? Can I do something different to create a different emotional experience, even when the outside world doesn't change? And of course, when we apply this to our relationships, it's really natural to want our others around us to be different from a very well-intentioned place quite often. And again, a lot of this is how we learned. We learned that the world is responsible for our feelings. We live reactively. It's very natural then that we feel victim to the world around us. So when we're talking about emotions, when we're talking about stress resilience, tolerating emotions, all of that maps onto our individual nervous system. So how do I create the space, the safety? Might mean changing my interaction with that environment, acknowledging that it plays a role. But if I'm going to just demand the environment be different, what happens when it doesn't change? Then I really disempower myself.
Yeah, there's so many moments in life where we run up against a situation where we can have our vision of how we want somebody to be. We can have our vision of even what's best for them. We can have our vision of what's best for us and how they should treat us. And they're a whole and complete person on their own. They're living their own journey. And we could wish and hope that they could just get it together. And sometimes they don't. And that's actually part of life too. And one thing that I've found is that the more that I invest in these grounding practices that you talk about inside of your book, the more I also have a deeper sense of understanding for other people. The more you understand that, wow, okay, here's how my childhood sort of impacted my upbringing, even if you've had what you consider to be like a really good life and you haven't had any big T traumas that immediately come to the table. Like, no, I had some great parents, other stuff, but everybody goes through some things that are there, right? And I know you're a friend, you're a fan and a friend of Dr. Gabor Mate, and we are too, and he's been on the podcast a couple of times, and a new book, The Myth of Normal. And, you know, a lot of what we think is normal is not often normal. So we're all going through different experiences that are there. As simple as like, I grew up in an immigrant family. We kind of came to the US and my dad, just trying to provide a better life for us, would just move us around to different places in the US that he would just get a better job. Mm-hmm. And it was for us. And it's tough when you're making friends and all of a sudden you have to be the new people and you get bullied. You don't know how to bring it up. And even that's something that's there. Yeah. Was I, you know, I wasn't sexually abused. I didn't have this situation happen, but that's still an experience. That's a trauma and aversion, and it shapes your personality. And one of the ways that it shaped my personality, just to connect the dots for the people that are listening here, for my audience, is that I got really good at sort of what do I need to do to fit in immediately. When you move around enough and you have to fit into a situation, you have to get people to like you, to have friends, what do I need to do? Well, I became the resourceful guy. I became the guy that was good at getting things done for other people. And if you experience that, wow, people like me when I do that, not only do you overdo it, but when you're not doing it, you worry, will people like you anymore, right? And I'm sure there's other patterns in my life as well too, but that's just one example of like, wow, okay, now as a CEO with over 70 employees in my, you know, companies, and I'm building different projects and stuff, if I'm constantly thinking, how do I need to be liked? I may not make the tough decision that needs to be made. I may not be willing to have the tough conversation that needs to be had. There's a lot of different ways that pattern would get in the way of me needing to show up, not just for my own benefit, but for the benefit of those people around me. And I think that that awareness, when you understand how your childhood plays a role in shaping how you are as a human being, not only do you have compassion, as you were mentioning, for your caretaker, right? You talked about your caretaker was just doing the best that they were doing. They were dealing in their own survival situation. So I have so much compassion for my parents and other things like that. But then you also have compassion in those moments in the world where you maybe butt heads against other people and you're like, I get why they're acting this way. I may not agree with them, but I get it. And I have compassion for how they're showing up right now. I was just kind of a rant. I don't know if I had anywhere specific I was going with it, but I was just basically saying that the more I do the stuff that's talked about in the book, the more I'm actually more willing to have compassion and understanding for those around me too, even when we don't see eye to eye on things.
100%. I think when we see all of the different contributing factors to any, you know, choices we make, reactive or responsive, whatever it might be, that is the gift then we give. We see other people as the multidimensional, you know, beings that they are. And very similar to you, I can, you know, see experiences, have experiences in my life and view them as, even if it's someone acting unsavory in whatever way that it is, if we understand that that might be the only way that this person knows how to, you know, keep themselves safe, stable, grounded in this circumstance, and I can make space for, I might still remove myself or put up a boundary, but I can make space for to hold that compassion, to understand that what they're doing, again, was the best solution that worked at one time. It might not be appropriate or, you know, be for the betterment of what's happening now, but I can shift from needing to defend against what's happening to understanding what's happening. And I think ultimately when we talk about humans and I think one of the reasons why the work, you know, that I put out is so resonating is when it really comes down to it, regardless of, you know, where you're living and the community is very global, there is so much that unites us in that similarity. Yes, circumstances look different. Environments that we grew up in look different. Family structures look different. It looks different. But I think at the core, the dynamics are so much more similar than they are different. And that really can allow us, and my grand hope for all of the work and the reason why I put out, you know, workbooks and books and content every day is to really join us together in that compassionate space. I think if we see those similarities, we can hold that compassionate space safely for other humans to find their way to their self-expression. And I think ultimately that just then makes the human species, if you will, so much more coherent and stronger, back to that word that I actually quite like a lot, than some of the cycles that we even as humanity find ourselves in that are very divisive, very defending, that in my opinion are very much just based in that threat, that difference, right? Difference seen as threat. I think if we shift that and difference seen as humanity and part of our experience, we can then shift then the way we relate into much more compassionate.
So once we've gotten a better understanding of our body, which is mainly awareness that then leads to a lot of us being able to tap into some of these tools, even just in this moment, as you mentioned earlier, just in this moment, as you're sitting here, as you're walking, as you're on the treadmill of the gym, wherever you are right now, just what's the awareness of your body? How do you feel? What are you noticing? And then, of course, there's a bunch of different tools that we can go from there. But just even that, is there the awareness of the awareness? Is there awareness of the watcher, the thinker? So once we have more awareness and we have access to some of these tools that go through the body, what's the next step from there when it comes to the path of meeting our true self?
Yeah, we want to pay attention to those repetitive stories, that narration, even what we think of ourselves, oftentimes, which originates in our thinking mind, the stories about who we imagine ourselves to be as a person, in my opinion and belief, often they come out of our conditioning, come out of our past experience, and oftentimes do ourselves a disservice that they don't see all of who we are. So we want to pay attention to our mental world. Our ego is what I'm referencing. Every time we hear ourselves narrate life, who we think ourselves to be, who am I essentially in this world, we want to see how repetitive those stories really are. Because if we really want to talk about what our authentic self is or how it speaks to us or where it lives, it's not going to be in those repetitive narrations that we are coloring our day with. It'll be in our bodies. We'll have sensations. We have, you know, inner urges that speak more in the body, interestingly enough, than even in the mind at all. So we want to pay attention first to how much we're spending time in our mind and what repetitive things our mind is telling us. And that can give us clarity in terms of those early experiences and how they are coloring what is happening now.
What were some examples of some of those repetitive stories that you were telling yourself?
Yes.
In the early part of your journey?
Yeah, the number one repetitive story that I would see, and these usually come a great time to look, is when we're feeling emotional reactive, when we're feeling upset about something. And the more I would tune into whatever it was that happened, I didn't get a text response from my partner who I was waiting for a response from, or I came home and, you know, something wasn't done around the house as I imagined or expected it to be. What I would notice is as I was going about noticing the lack of text or the lack of whatever it was that wasn't happening, my narration was, I'm not being considered. All roads for me led back to some story about how what was happening was evidence of how not considered I am. And then, of course, if I imagine if I'm coloring every experience I'm having as being an indicator that I'm not being considered by, say, someone that I love and that's very important to me, now I can understand why I'm feeling so upset, right? Of course, if someone isn't considering me, it's going to produce hurt, anger, maybe even. For me, I can understand that repetitive story based in that early childhood experience of having, again, a parent who wasn't able to consistently attune to and consider, in particular, my emotional needs. In childhood, We are also dealing with a developmental immaturity of our meaning-making system. When we're from birth till, say, about age 7, we're in a very egocentric point of view, or we have a very egocentric point of view. We don't have the maturity to, like you just even acknowledge. I had a caregiver who, and you had caregivers who had other things going on in life, right? We didn't have the maturity to say, oh, well, you know, this can explain why, just using my example, my mom in her survival mode based on her childhood explains why I don't feel considered. I didn't have that maturity. All roads led back to some version of events where I played a role and I focused. So mom wasn't available to me because of something that was inherently wrong with me. I wasn't considered because of something inherently that was wrong with me. And I can understand now why the more I repeated that narration, the reason why I felt so upset now, flash forward in time in adulthood, when I wasn't being considered. Calling into question, though, the reality of that, right? Seeing time after time that these people I was surrounding myself with are humans who consider me. It was my own narration that was causing the upset.
So in a way, it's like you're seeing the situation. It's like, this reminds me of kind of how I was being raised. Yeah. And reminds in this moment, my partner not doing the dishes or leaving a bunch of stuff out when I come back from work is in a way kind of to like our childlike brain. It's like, they're just like my mom and they're not seeing me. Do you think that I'm not being considered? Does that also tie into a way you hear some of these, you know, one of the core stories that a lot of people have is I'm not good enough. Is there a relationship to that or is there not? And feel free to disagree with me. I'm just asking.
Yeah, there's absolutely a relationship. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. I think that lays at our core. And all of this goes down to, again, messages around objectively whether or not we had someone consistently present to meet our needs. In absence of having that present person, that very immature narration will come up with a very eye-focused reason, right? My mom wasn't here to meet my physical needs, my emotional needs, whatever needs it was, because I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough to have those needs met. And the reality, again, is because parenting is a very large task. We need to be very conscious, attuned individuals who know how to consistently meet their needs, be stable and grounded in their bodies, that they can hold space to explore, you know, with curiosity, their child. And the reality, for very intergenerational reasons, many different reasons, our parents weren't equipped to do that. And very few of us, I think, have had that consistency of having our needs met. So most of us, I believe, have that core feeling of not being worthy in some area. And in my opinion, all of that goes back to the very real lived experience of when someone's not available, the only way I can make sense of it, even if a parent leaves the home, parents get a divorce, right? Usually a child, the way they will make sense of it is the child has done something wrong. I was not worthy of having this parent present to me. Again, in reality, none of that was the case. There's many different factors and reasons why parents can't meet or won't meet children's needs consistently enough. Though, when it comes down to just whether or not my needs were met, in absence of having a consistently attuned individual to meet them, likely we will develop some version of that. I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough. I'm not considered. I'm not having my needs met.
How do we get better at catching these stories? It's one of the toughest things for people to catch themselves when they're in a story, because the mind literally will convince you, well, is it the mind? Is it the ego? I'd love your thoughts on that. It'll literally convince you that you have the whole situation figured out. Yes. I was just talking to a friend a couple nights ago, and she was outlining a situation that happened to do with family, and she was so sure the way that she was thinking about it, really the narrative, was exactly what happened. So how do we get better at catching that? Have you found any tips, hacks, any kind of things that are there that make it easier at catching when we're playing a game with ourselves by repeating an old narrative that's not serving us?
I love how you're even using, Drew, the word catching it. Because I think that's an important place to start, because I think sometimes we have the idea that we can stop our thoughts, our narration, we can kind of squash it. And I think the conversation really is more about noticing and catching by proxy of diverting our attention, which I'll just get to in a minute. But it's not to have the idea, let me put it this way, or the expectation that, you know, even having a conversation about being conscious of these stories. Oh, now I know that I can be conscious of these stories. Oh, once I maybe even discover my story will go away. It's not going to go away. Our subconscious mind will always attempt to narrate life, typically in that very familiar habitual way. So it will be a conversation then of becoming conscious, noticing as you're narrating the events, as you begin to go down that familiar rut of, oh, I didn't get that text response. Oh, it's because, okay, I'm not going to focus my attention on that. I'm going to give myself the opportunity, because typically what we do is we tend to reiterate then. We repeat the same thing and we talk about in our mind's eye about how unconsidered we are until we're really down the spiral in an emotional upset.
People always do this. This always happens to me.
We use those kind of total, you know, statements about things. So getting really clear that we're not going to stop it, notice when it happens and remove our focus. Another one of those really simple, right, techniques that in actuality can go a very long way, because more often than not, we don't notice. We're already down the spiral. We're saying always, never, we're rehashing it. And now we already feel terrible. If in real time, I notice that, oh my gosh, there's that old story again, I'm not even gonna shame myself for it. Of course, my subconscious, that's all it knows to do in this moment is to assume this is the case. Now I can shift my focus. I can put it on what I'm doing in the moment. I can maybe put it on my breath. I can do something else, and removing my focus might be what stops me from going down that spiral. And then of course we can expand and look for information that maybe even counters that particular story, because what happens, our ego or this narrative then colludes with a part of our brain called the reticular activating system that to deal with the too much major amount of stimulation that we can't deal with anyway, we're selective. And what we do is we like to self-confirm. So if I believe I'm not considered, my mind is going to delete any other version of evidence that I could be being considered in this moment in favor of being right. So if I shift my focus, I can be conscious about it and maybe look for disconfirming information. Yes, my partner might not be responding to my texts in this moment. The dishes might not be in the sink the way that I want them. Though, is there some other way that I can notice, even back to your goal setting in a way, can I notice that my partner actually did consider me? Maybe there was something that happened earlier in the day that was evidence of consideration. My mind will have deleted that likely in favor of being right, in favor of strengthening how not considered I am. So then we can be intentional, expand, and see all of the other evidence that counters what our old belief was.
So one narrative that people can be running is this, I'm not being considered. Give us some examples of some other common narratives that are out there in the world so that people can see like, huh, try that on, fit. Does that match sort of, you know, some of the narratives that you might be using? Are there some other examples of those that are out there?
Yeah, I think another really common one is I'm an imposter. You know, I'm not who I say I am. A lot of that, interestingly, goes back to, right, am I living based on these habits, how I think I have to be to, you know, be validated, to show up in my relationships, or am I showing up as my authentic self? I think in terms of business and achievement and when we're going into kind of actualizing, a lot of times we don't feel secure in who we are. We feel like an imposter. We feel like we're going to be found out for all the flaws that we have below the surface. I think that's another really, really common one.
And then people are going to leave us and we'll have nobody. We're going to die homeless or whatever.
Yep. Yeah. Some version of that. And typically that is where the beliefs go to, right? If I show who I truly am, if I show all of me, you know, even these darker spots, parts of my person or my experience or whatever it might be, I think that is where the road leads to, this underlying belief. And maybe at a time and a place, those parts weren't acceptable. Maybe you were shamed in childhood for showing certain aspects of your emotions or of your curiosity or of your just self-expression by just being you. So again, this goes back to what you were describing, what we were kind of acknowledging earlier, the similarity, right? When we have big reactions, when we find ourselves going back to those old habitual ruts, chances are it's because there is a similarity, and it might even just be in how we're narrating what's happening, but to those older times. And then it makes sense why we react the way that we do. So the person who does is hiding aspects of ourself in fear of being found out might be evidence that at some time and at some place that part of you actually wasn't welcomed, or there was, you know, a threat to showing that you did live the experience of.
So I'm an imposter slash like I'm not good enough. Are there any other couple that just like one or two that you might want to throw out there, like common narratives that you see out there in the world that people are running, and that narrative sort of puts a lens on their experiences and now they see everything through that lens when things are stressful or times are tough or they're not really sure the next step. One or two others that you think of?
I'm too much is a really good one. I'm dramatic. I'm weak on maybe the other side of that, kind of countering on that like power, I'm powerful thing, I'm weak. Mm. I think we can globalize a lot of statements about ourselves based on these really kind of dichotomous things, strong, weak, you know.
So it's fair to say that any time you're noticing sort of a little background of like a disempowering story, it's almost always, if not always, going to be something that's probably a pattern, a narrative that's not true. Is that fair to say?
It's good to question. I think it's a great—
It's a good opportunity to question.
Question, to get curious.
Even if people just added the word maybe at the end of it and then use it as an opportunity for inquiry.
Yeah.
So catching these stories once we have more body awareness, and I think body is really the key because sometimes you feel it in your gut before you think it in your head. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that everybody always notices that. You do if you've done the work or you've even dabbled into it a little bit, but often we'll feel it in the body. One of our friends who's been on the podcast before, Dr. Andrew Huberman, he says, we cannot access the mind through the mind. We have to access it through body, which is the same thing that you're saying in this situation, which is why when we are super stressed out, when we are overwhelmed, overloaded, and especially for people who are heavy on the thinking side, mm-hmm. and are just like, I just need to think about this. I need to just, even sometimes people who are very verbal, I just need to talk about this right now. You'll see this often in relationships where people are like, no, we have a problem. We have an issue. We need to talk about it right now. What would happen instead of just, maybe you guys, even if you don't always feel like it, and there's nothing wrong with taking a break. Everybody says, okay, fine, 20-minute break, whatever. But you come back before you talk and you just went on a walk together, right? Or even just you solo went on a walk a little bit outside. Just took a few moments to do something where you had a chance to access your body. It's a whole other way that you're getting to tackle now a problem in your life.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, being in our talking mind, our thinking mind, that's a very different mind than being in our body mind. I mean, I can even make a case, and I see a lot of times even consciousness itself as a practice is often misinterpreted to mean self-analyzing, endless self-thinking, right? And that's not actually a state of consciousness at all. That's being trapped in just another version of thought, only it's self-focused. And, you know, a lot of times I think we can misattribute or think that we're healing by always thinking about ourselves. But again, I can make the case that we're still in our thinking mind in terms too of communicating. A lot of times, especially when we're communicating our different deeper feelings, those are two separate systems. Putting sensory feelings, sensations into words is building a bridge. And there's a lot when we really unpack trauma, especially trauma that happens early on, one of the most difficult things is our inability to talk about it. When it happens pre-verbally or even where it's stored in our brain is in a non-verbal section of our brain, to really simplify it, talking about it can often be what is incredibly difficult, even if not impossible for some of us. Yet we do then have others who attempt talking or thinking as maybe even a distraction from what's feeling or what's happening deeper in our body. So I love that suggestion in terms of localizing ourselves, in terms of being in our body and learning the difference between overthinking, over-talking. Something I continue to work for myself is learning how to be in my own stillness, not always filling the air, distracting myself with thoughts in my mind, or always, I typically do this with other people, not just talking for the sake of talking when I'm in a social environment, filling the air, learning how to just be in my feelings. And I can notice both of those tendencies to shift into hyperthinking in my mind, to shift into hyper talking for me as a result of feeling uncomfortable in myself. So learning how to harness that discomfort and sit in it, as opposed to distracting myself away from the body and the discomfort in my body by focusing on filling the air with my speech or focusing on filling my mind with my thoughts and just being in my discomfort, allowing me to get curious and maybe more clarity on what's really happening for me, and then maybe making the choice to communicate that in some way.
I get so excited when I catch myself running a pattern, because it's almost like the sense of like, anybody who's done any kind of mobility work or sort of fascial release, you find that sore spot and you're like, oh boy, that hurts. But I'm so glad I found it, because there was some tension there. And if I get to the root of that tension, then tomorrow I'm going to be able to do a heavier deadlift, or I'll be able to run faster. And I get so excited because it's this sense of, I always am assuming, like my genuine default assumption is that I'm running a few blind spots at any given time, right? That's just my default, because I understand human nature. And I also have forgiveness on myself to know that I'm still doing my best and I'm committed to the work, but it's just going to happen. You talked about being still in front of other people. I remember when I started down this journey and had a few mentors in this space, right when I was kind of like dropping out of school, and I did a few programs that were very helpful for me, you know, similar path that you had, it just in my own contextual journey, I would often find myself listening a lot more to other people. And I would listen because I was trying to just notice the times that my mind would go into, okay, I need to prove myself to this person. I had dropped out of school at the time. I was a young entrepreneur. And I'm always thinking, like, at that time, one of the narratives I'm running is that, does the person think of me as successful? And when you are listening to somebody and you're about to talk, if that's the narrative that's there, you're constantly improving. And there's no greater way to actually show that you're not actually successful than trying to prove yourself as needing to be successful in that moment. And I would see that pattern, and I would say, okay, you know, I'm just going to watch. I'm just going to listen. And I would just acknowledge some of the times, like, oh, I wanted to chime in here about that. I know about this. I wanted to do that to prove this situation. Nothing wrong with genuinely adding to the conversation, connecting, engaging with somebody, just having fun. And I found those moments so fulfilling. Even today, as much as work as I feel that I've done, I still have moments where, actually, my friends make fun of me now in my men's group, especially, because sometimes I'll say a statement. I'll say, you know what? Actually, I don't know if that's true. I think I just said that. I'm just going to let me just check myself on that. What I really meant is this. And I love those moments. And it's a teaching moment for me. And it's also helpful for the people around me. So I kind of am excited about catching myself. And I think the world would be a better place if we all had that sense, with also knowing that it doesn't mean that we're broken. It doesn't mean that we have some major faults that can't be corrected. It's just part of the genuine human experience of us all learning and growing together with each other.
Yeah, I think anytime we can become more present to ourselves, we're adding to our learning, you know, and our ability then to use what we're seeing in our own presence to inform a different future choice. I mean, there's even a part in the workbook about conscious listening and really just starting to pay attention to how we listen. And because it's so common for us, I mean, you're describing it in the context of proving yourself. I mean, more often than not, when we're listening to someone else, we're actually listening more to our own thoughts, right? You said this word. Oh, I have a retort. I'm going to say this instead. Oh, I might even outwardly interrupt you because what you said is inaccurate, and I'm going to, you know, kind of shift what it is and offer my two cents. And the reality of it is, very few of us are able to be in our own presence, noticing those distracting moments, those internal dialogues, to then be able to put that aside, to then join someone else in presence around them and their ideas ultimately. So when we are present to ourselves with all of the information going through our minds, coming from our bodies, none of that means that we're broken. That actually just can be harnessed as more information for us to maybe modify the choices that we're making moving forward. So as I'm watching and hearing myself want to, you know, retort to what you said or defend or, you know, present myself in this one way, seeing that as information, not judging myself, might give me the opportunity to make the choice not to do that and to shift back into listening mode if that's my intention at that moment.
Do you still find yourself today, for the folks that are listening, do you still find yourself today catching that same
narrative that I'm not being considered.
Oh, it's very, very, very present still. In multiple occasions, usually I notice it when my resources are low, and typically when I notice it now, very interestingly, it becomes a marker for me to explore and get curious of how good I'm doing at considering myself, because those are the moments when I'm not, when I'm running on empty, when I have work and I'm stressed out and I'm maybe not taking those moments to make sure my needs are as consistently met, where now I am in my emotional brain more. I'm not as regulated in my nervous system. So it makes sense in terms of the neuro kind of biology of things. And it also then gives me the invitation to say, okay, Nicole, if you're consistently feeling not considered, there might be information in there. It might not be your partner's responsibility like you once believed it was. This might be the invitation to notice that, you know what, you're not sleeping as well and your plate is a little bit overfilled. And maybe you can consider yourself a little better moving forward, continue to meet your own needs and allow yourself to go back into that more calm, stable, grounded baseline. So still present, shift it, I think, instead of outward blaming, taking it as, again, that informational opportunity. And usually it does point back to something is missing, though. If I hold myself responsible, I can give myself then that need.
And sometimes it could be those basic of needs, like you said, sleeping. Mm-hmm. Did you eat on time? Did you eat enough? Mm-hmm. Right? Which a lot of high achievers, you know, will skip meals and move on to the next thing. I think it's a great reminder that it's called the work because you got to keep on doing it, right? It's like that Byron Katie quote, right? She calls it the work because if you stop doing it, it stops working. And that can be applied for every single thing that's out there, including the basic needs. In the writing of this workbook and putting these tools together for folks, was there a section that you were writing down that even for you, you were like, oh, this is very timely in the context of the self-development space right now? Like, this is an area that's a little bit overlooked or may not be getting enough attention as it sort of deserves. And I think people are going to really resonate with this. Anything in that kind of category that you put inside the book that you were like, ah, I really feel like this is a little gem inside of the book right now?
I think that what I'm hoping that a lot of people resonate with and find helpful in terms of understanding themselves better is basing, I think, a lot of the original or beginning conversation, especially on the body, and mapping that onto the nervous system. I think that for a lot of people, I don't know if it's necessary. I think it's thankfully becoming a very commonly talked about piece of one's healing journey, though I think kind of mapping on, especially at the beginning of the workbook, in terms of nervous system and understanding the different cues, I think that can hopefully offer people the most life-changing piece of information to then apply. Because time and time again, I've seen this in myself, I've seen this in my community. When really we really do tune into the nervous system in particular in the body, we can relieve ourselves of a lot of the shame, of these explosive moments where we do really believe that something might be wrong with us, or we're unable to be connected or feel connected to our relationships. We might think that there's something wrong with us, we're doomed or destined to be alone, only to uncover that the reason we feel so unsafe, disconnected, is because of our nervous system. So for me, I think that becomes the most implementable tool that creates the most actionable and empowering change.
Well, I'm glad we spent the first you know, majority of the podcast on that, because it really felt like the sequencing of that is a very special thing. You know, we even doubled down on it earlier in it, is that you have to start first from here before we go elsewhere. Okay, so now we're better at catching stories. We're accessing the body. We have some breathwork tips and tools. We have some other things, and especially an area that we didn't talk about, which I'm hoping people pick the workbook on, is there's also a section on like setting an intention, right? About like, what is the reason? Like, even from just the good enough answer that we have right now, we can always refine it. Like, why do we even want to go down this journey in the first place? Setting an intention for what we want out of this. Why do we want to go about it? We won't talk about too much of that right now. They'll have to get that from the book. But now that we're better at catching these stories, noticing them, seeing it, and we're developing into the pyramid and building from there, what is one of the other categories we want to get a chance to touch on here in the sequencing of meeting our true self?
So as we begin to peel back and discover all of the reactive ways that, you know, aren't kind of in alignment with who we want to be, then we can gift ourselves with moments to really drop in and discover, you know, what we're passionate about, what we're curious about. And I think the next extension then is to live into those moments, find more moments of flow, of that alignment, of being able to, whether or not it's just with your friends, expressing your ideas, your thoughts, your feelings, and just being you, or translating your flow into what you do in terms of your passion and your life's purpose and journey. I think that is the natural byproduct once we've removed all of the other shoulds and reasons why we do the things that we do and create the space to drop in and discover what we want. Then I think the next step is to make the choices in action to actualize that want. And I think that then byproduct is living in flow. And I think the more we're just connected to our beingness, able to live in that self-expression without censoring for all of those reasons, that in my opinion is life in flow, whether or not we do translate it, because I think a lot of times we think of flow in terms of our achievement, right? In this kind of space of performing, I can make a case that flow is the presence of living life in our own beingness and in our own presence. And I think that is the goal of ultimately the workbook, or one of the biggest goals of our finding and meeting our authentic self, is to build in and expand those moments where we just feel safe enough to be who we are in whatever context that is.
What's something that you love to do as a kid that sort of has shown up in your career today? And maybe you lost it in that period where you were performing for everybody else and a clinical psychologist, and you're doing everything for everybody else in the narrative and that sort of thing. But you kind of rediscovered it as an adult, and it's like now a major part of your life. Like, is there something like that that you love to do as a kid?
Yeah, for a very long time. I mean, I was creative as a kid in the traditional sense, in terms of in the art classes, you know, like drawing, producing, like artistic type creativity. And lost, would not have probably for the middle portion of two decades of my life, would never have aligned myself or described myself as a creative being. In absence of, I mean, I stopped doing that more structured art. I didn't even believe myself to be a creator of really anything in this life. And again, I understand all that now. When we're in survival mode, creativity is not, again, a priority. So for me, not only returning art and those more traditional modes of creation are back in my more consistent life now, but I actually am able to embody a feeling of, as I believe all of us humans are, of just being a creator, of being able to share ideas and the work that I now put out in terms of content and books and creation in that more global general sense. So I really lost the connection with, I think, our inherent creative nature, with my inherent creative nature, in service of performing, overstepping my limits, exhausting myself, driving me into the point of losing consciousness, and being able to reconnect, rebalance my body, and rediscover the fact that, in my opinion, again, living in flow comes hand in hand with living as a creative being. And it doesn't mean just creating art that we put on a wall or a book that is a tangible thing. I think that we are a living creation and just expressing ourselves and our ideas with the world around us.
I love that as an example, because I forgot who shared the story, but there's the classic story of like somebody going into a teacher going into like a first grade class and saying, all right, like who here in the class is good at singing? And like everybody like raises their hand. Right? Like kids are naturally creative. They want to be creative. They want to attempt to do stuff. They want to do things like that. And then as you go up the grades, you know, less and less hands are, you know, raised and everything like that. And I love that example that, you know, even if somebody's an accountant and numbers is their thing, creativity could be showed up outside of your profession. It doesn't have to always be your job. It could be anything, and it could be your job. It could be a creative approach to solving a problem that wasn't, that you didn't see previously, or working with a more creative team. There's so many people who, in a way, almost don't even feel like they're deserving of having some of that joy through their profession or even in their life as a whole. And I think that kids recognize, in a way, that no, joy is actually a part of life. Like, I want to have joy, I want to have play. And doing this work is a big part of re-stepping back into that and having more fun, being more into your body. So I'm excited for people to go down that journey. Are there any tools, now as we get into that, like people often will ask that same question, well, I don't know what I want to do. I don't know what I actually like. Are there any ways they can start to notice that, tap into it, any tools in the workbook that you've put together
that are good at catching these sections where it's like, oh, well, here's a little thread that I should pull on of something that I actually want to give a little bit more attention to in my life.
I think revisiting, for some of us, it's revisiting what we used to like to do and have gotten away from. I think so many of us have that disconnection that we might not be able to locate now, though if it was something that was important to us in childhood and for whatever reason we stopped or weren't able to pursue it, I think kind of exploring and revisiting kind of what once was joyful or, you know, fun or creative for us can be a really great place to revisit. And I think sometimes it can be a matter of just, you know, pausing and giving ourselves the space to wonder. I think a lot of times, especially as we age into adulthood, if we don't immediately know, we go into this self-shaming mode and don't even give ourselves the opportunity to try things on for size. I mean, if there wasn't the childhood thing that maybe even pops up to mind, exploring now, like what are things that might be of interest? Maybe try a couple different things, new hobbies, and seeing. It might not be the first thing that sticks or that feels in alignment, but a lot of times we need to just pause to do that. And this beautifully comes full circle, right? Creating the moments where I feel safe enough to pause, creating the opportunity to have that curious exploration, the space, the time, the energy, the safety in my body to even be able to engage with that. And then trying things on. I think as adults, we have this idea that if I don't immediately know, or if it doesn't stick, or I might make the wrong choice, and we wait all of these choices instead of just giving ourselves the unstructured opportunity to experiment. I think that for a lot of us will lead us in the direction of what it is that is ultimately meant for us.
I love that. Like experimenting and just trying and tasting.
Trying.
Tasting a bunch of different stuff. How do you know if you like this vegetable or this thing or this food? You try it. Mm-hmm. And then you tell me, did you like it? Did you not? Okay, you didn't. Let's go try something else. Okay, you weren't a fan of this, you know, dish. Let's go try something else. And through that process of discovery, you get to figure out more of what you actually really want in life. What has been in this process, because some of this is also a culmination of the work from the first book, but also getting that message out and seeing what resonates and doesn't resonate with people and kind of tweaking it and modifying it. What has been some of the things that you have found as people who listen to this podcast, they probably are at least aware of a lot of these components that we're talking about. Now, whether or not they're practicing it is always the question. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason that I love workbooks, is that they get you to do the practice. But if they are aware of it, and they have some of the basics that they're doing, maybe they need to increase the frequency, what is there for them to look forward to as they start to get in the deeper rungs and literally, like physically in your book, once they start to get closer to the end, right? What's available for them? What's a preview of what can be incorporated into their life? What's a preview of what they can have access to that maybe they don't have access to now as they start to work through some of these exercises and try them on for size?
I think, you know, in addition to having space, resources, you know, opportunity to explore, you know, different aspects of who we are, I think the byproduct of that really is transformational. In addition to allowing ourselves the release from, you know, things that are us, if we're not able to express them, I do believe it is an energetic, you know, stagnation stoppage. We feel it translating in our body. So the more in alignment, the more that comes out of us, the more we feel that actual relief, that connection, that flow, that ease. I think ease comes to mind and is very much part of my experience, where things felt, you know, very, you know, difficult, very disconnected. Being able to live in ease for me means identifying what I want and creating the circumstances to allow that to be the case in my life. Maybe not immediately now, but somewhere down the line. I think when we empower ourselves with intention, when we connect with what it is that we want, and then the more we practice creating the opportunity to meet those needs in the world, I do think energetically things become more easeful. Things, we gravitate to the friendships, the relationships that are much more aligned for us, the opportunities maybe in our personal or professional life that then allow alignment, not only what I want, am I expressing that outward, but I think that allows us to then live in alignment with the environments and the relationships around us, which to me translates to that idea or that concept of ease.
There's Marianne Williamson poem, and I don't have it in front of me, so I won't read it, but the basic concept is that it's not our darkness that most of us fear. It's actually our light, right? Like many people are actually scared of just how brightly they could shine. First of all, what are your thoughts on that? And have you ever seen that this fear of my authentic self and really what I'm capable of doing is something that holds people back from starting down the journey?
I think it, you know, very much plays a role, as counterintuitive as that might sound. You know, of course, I think on the surface, like, of course, like there's bright light shining outward. But if, again, in childhood, that wasn't the message, if it wasn't safe to do that, that's the memory that my adult self is going to revert back to. So even in absence of allowing that light to shine, that fear might be so strong of all of those moments where I was shamed, where, you know, I was abandoned, where I was rejected, are going to be so close to the surface that that might even prevent me from allowing that to be who I am in that moment. And again, this is so counterintuitive because I think logically, right, this is, of course, I want my light to shine. But when there was a risk inherently attached to that fullness of our bright light, then it will prevent us from allowing that to be the case. And the reality of it is, again, we were limited. We were suppressed. I mean, even sometimes being, and I remember moments in childhood where in particular, when I was playing softball and, you know, being, you know, quite good at pitching, I was a softball pitcher, and I would hear from a lot of my, you know, people I was playing, my opponents, if you will, I couldn't think of that word, negative, you know, not wanting to play against me, not wanting to bat against me, saying negative things about, you know, my talent in that area. And for a very long time, I was very self-aware and not a positive. I was almost, you know, I there was a part of me that while I allowed myself to perform, because that, remember, got my mom love and got my mom's attention, I was self-conscious about the fact that me being good at something resulted in someone else feeling bad about themselves at something. And being, as I think we all are, compassionate creatures, the more that happened, the more I too had this idea and this messaging that, you know, don't be too good. Don't show too much of what you're capable of, because you could hurt someone as a result of that. And that's just a very real lived experience of some version of messaging where, again, our brightness at some time did continue to make me diminish, or contributed to me continuing to diminish out of that concern. Well, if I show who I am, that might make you feel bad about yourself. And I don't want you to feel bad about yourself. So I'll just dim my light a little bit.
That's really interesting, that example. Would you say that, you know, you've been shining brightly and using the power of social media as an opportunity to introduce a lot of these things to people who previously would have never heard of it? They're not maybe the person to pick up a book necessarily, but they're going to be on Instagram. They're going to be on TikTok. Do you feel that in your career now as an adult and the holistic psychologist and everything like that, do you think there are times where did that narrative ever come back to you, that you felt that some of the criticism that people are trying to place on you is coming from the fact that, like, you're just shining brightly and doing your thing, so you're going to be a target, so people are going to place on top of you their own projection of the situation? Any thoughts about that?
My concern about what other people would think about me and my message was present since the moment I created that Instagram account. Very much like, oh my gosh, what are colleagues going to think as I talk about this model of holistic wellness? What are people going to think as I begin to share my own personal journey of healing? Maybe I shouldn't share more fully how it was for me or what my experiences are. I talk about my family a lot. Well, my family think of me talking, right? So all of this kind of self-censoring has been ever present in terms of my decisions about what, how much to share. And initially, I think I allowed myself to defer a bit more in terms of fear of how will it be for other people to hear what my truth and what my reality is, and have now in the more recent year or two gotten to a place of many more moments of flow where I'm not kind of censoring or, oh, don't say it this way, say it that way, because this person might think that. And so over time, it's actually been a really big gift. And the other side of it then, of course, comes with what interpretations people offer to what they hear or think I'm saying, then offers me the gift of learning how to tolerate, you know, moments of how people are reacting to my message based on, again, their own subjective, nuanced, multifaceted experiences of being human, colored by all of their experiences and filters that they're bringing to my message as well. So a little bit on the front end, a little bit different on the continued end, all still very much part of my journey of navigating. Because one of the things when we put ourselves, you know, or are talking our message to an audience, it's how truthful and how honest are we going to be and what will the reaction be? And that's, I think, an ongoing conversation.
But the beautiful thing about that is that we do difficult things because it makes us a better, more whole, more complete version of who we already always were. And we like strip off that onion. It's like, this is the lifting of weights of life and getting criticism from people. And sure, there might be times where we're like, okay, great. I'm going to weigh this out. Does this feel like anything that I needed to be thinking about? Okay, I get it. All right, I'm going to modify. And everybody goes through that. I go through that all the time. You know, an employee might feel that I didn't handle a situation or that they were removed from the company unfairly. I didn't see all the good things that they brought in. You know, I was only focused on the bad stuff. But we go through these experiences because it makes us stronger. And we go through these experiences because hopefully, especially the more that we're connected to meeting our true self, we tend to want to gravitate towards work in the world that makes people's lives better. Even if it's in a small little corner of wherever our world is, which everything is a little small corner of our world. And it, and we have that moment where we realize it's like, it's not just about us. Like, I'm doing it for other people as well too, to get benefit from the work that I'm getting a chance to put out there. Like, so many people want this feeling of like, I wish I just didn't care what other people thought about me. And they forget that the way to get to that place is you do the work where it's not that people aren't criticizing you anymore. They're still criticizing you. They're still saying things about you. They're still talking about you, but you actually just don't even have room for that because it's a distraction for you doing what you're meant to do here. Does that feel like it resonates to you? Would you say it differently?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very beautiful way. And interestingly, and kind of pulling this, again, conversation full circle, really learning how to tolerate, how to develop our own resilience is what this, I believe, human journey is about. I mean, we are interpersonal. We're always going to be surrounded by people, by relationships. Of course, if you're online, it's going to be a multitude of them. And really the question is returning to, how can I be me in all of these different contexts with all of these differing opinions and all of these different humans with their own life experiences that are going to be factored into the mix? And that then comes only as a byproduct, like you're beautifully sharing, of interacting, of learning, of first discovering who we are and of developing the confidence to be who we are, regardless of, again, that the feedback or the validation around us.
Nicole, before we go into kind of final thoughts and all the other good stuff that comes from people finding out how to keep in touch with you, et cetera, is there any other parts of the book that we didn't get a chance to touch on that you want to highlight? And no pressure if you feel like we're pretty complete, but just wanted to give you that opportunity.
Let me think. I think we did a really, really great job of stepping our way through the book. I think it was really a comprehensive journey in terms of, you know, ending with flow. I have some bits on kind of creativity in there and learning, you know, how to rediscover ourselves in terms of being that creative being. I think we did a really great job of going through it. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you. And for anybody who has heard our first conversation, at that time, I don't remember the exact situation, but you were very vulnerable that you were sharing about a place and time that you were in your life where I think there was a family member that you were kind of like had to set more firmer boundaries with. And we don't have to go into it if you don't want to. If you want to share, you could share. But just checking in, like, how are you and your family doing in the sense of like everybody's a human being and doing their best? And, you know, and yeah, just me as a friend, just checking in on you and how everybody's doing.
I appreciate that. I think when I'm not sure exactly what moment in time you're talking about, but hearing boundaries in terms of family, I know that that was a big part of creating safety for me, for my own self-expression in my family unit. And what that then looked like was different degrees of navigating things differently, making choices to limit certain, you know, engagements that I would be a part of. And ultimately, I actually think my first book left off with me making the very big decision to cut off contact with my entire family for a period. It ended up being about 18 months that I, you know, took a big hard separation for me in hopes of creating a bit of space for this beginning of the exploration. I was so used to filtering and performing in particular with my family mostly, that creating that hard stop and that hard boundary gave me a bit of space to explore myself. And probably about 18 months into it, I started to feel, you know, grounded enough in my own presence and, you know, safe enough to continue, or with the hope that I would be able to continue or maintain those boundaries for myself and my own authentic self-expression when I re-engaged contact with them. I reached out without any awareness. We had actually no contact at all over that 18-month period. So I had no idea or expectation of where they would be or where they wouldn't be, if they would be interested in even re-engaging contact with me, how they even reacted to my asked for separation. And the gift that I was given was when I had emailed them to just let them know that, you know, I was hoping to open the door for contact, and I was completely open to seeing where they were at around that. And they had let me know that they were all in versions of individual and family therapy over that course of time as well. We re-engaged our contact actually in the context of some family therapy, and have since, we're a couple of years now into our reunification with new boundaries. Relationships have really changed a lot. I feel much more authentically connected. I have a deeper relationship with my family members now as a result of that separation. So I appreciate you asking. And I share this a lot too, because I think this is a really prime example of space, of safety, and of sometimes us needing to disconnect or put up boundaries from even some of our longest relationships to be able to begin to explore some of these deeper questions and this process that this workbook will hopefully aid listeners in. So for me, it was creating a bit of just breathing room to give me the opportunity so that when I went back to these relationships, it was more authentically me. And now as a result, I feel more authentic and more connected to them as a result.
That's a beautiful note to conclude on. It really highlights the possibility of everybody's situation is different. Everybody's going to need a different sort of way of, you know, relating or redefining the relationship with their family. Sometimes it's going to be a very period of time of separation. I've had friends that have said, like, listen, I'm going to love you from a distance for a little while. Like, it's not working. But one of my best friends, you know, growing up, we were business partners for a little while, and we had to take a little period of time. Mm-hmm. And then it was just like 6 months, and then we were able to reconnect. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, you know, he did a lot of development work. I did a lot of mm-hmm. development work, and now we're like best friends still. Mm-hmm. And we're able to enjoy that relationship. And there's other times where people are at a place where they can do the work with you. Yep. And they can go on that journey with you. And that's a beautiful thing, but it's all taking us to this place of a word that you shared earlier, which I'd love to end on, is ease, living our life with less ease and less anxiety. So many people have so much anxiety on a day-to-day basis of feeling pulled in a direction of the demands of the world, the demands of the people around them, and not being able to share how they truly feel about a situation, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. But when we tap into this work and we actually are practicing on a regular basis, prioritizing it and working through the body first mm-hmm. to access it, that's what's possible for us. Ease is possible for us. Less anxiety and more joy in our life. So thank you, Nicole, for being the vehicle to share that message, which you've done so eloquently. And I appreciate you coming on the podcast. The workbook is out, How to Meet Yourself, the workbook for self-discovery. It builds on everything that we talked about in the first book for those who picked it up. And the other places that you want to send our audience to, they can follow you online.
Yes, pretty much every social media channel, I think by now I have a presence on, Search the Holistic Psychologist. Of course, it all began on the Instagram account, though, for all the TikTokers, YouTubers, Twitter folk out there. I'm the Holistic Psychologist across all of those. My website, theholisticpsychologist.com. You get some more information on how to order the book on my virtual community, the Self Healers Circle. Those are great places to keep in contact. And thank you, Drew. This has been a great conversation. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you. I absolutely super appreciate you for coming back on and sharing your journey. Thanks. Of course.